This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachel. Well, if you saw the Oscars this year, you know that some folks thought that host Chris Rock's introduction of three children as accountants was offensive.
The results of tonight's Academy Awards have been tabulated by the accounting firm of Price, Waterhouse, and Cooper. They sent us their most dedicated, accurate, and hardworking representatives. So I want you to please welcome Ming Zhu, Bao Ling, and David Moskowitz.
I don't know, but in the world of humor, was that offensive? Is there an ethical line that comedians should not cross? And if so, who decides where that line rests? My two guests today study ethics in humor, particularly as it relates to race. They're participants in a conference at UNC this weekend that takes an interdisciplinary approach to humor. They're part of a panel called The Ethics of Humor, Navigating Racial Satire. Lavelle Anderson is a philosophy professor at the University of Memphis whose research focuses on racial humor. Lavelle, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Also with us, Jeff Sebo, participating in the talk. He's a philosophy professor at UNC, the director of the Parr Center for Ethics. Hello, Jeff.
Hi. Nice to be here.
Good to have you. You were a comedian before you took an academic approach to this topic. Do you think there are boundaries?
Well, I performed comedy. I'm not sure I would call myself a comedian.
you're overthinking this, Jeff.
Oh, I do that all the time with everything.
Okay.
I am a philosopher.
Yeah,
I absolutely do think there are ethical boundaries. I think that comedy can be ethically incredibly important, but also ethically sometimes harmful and oppressive, and we need to be careful about walking that line in the right kind of way.
When you say you're saying there should be boundaries, because obviously people are crossing them all the time, right?
I absolutely do.
Lavelle, your interest is really developed after a tweet on the Colbert Show, or at least it's something you're going to talk about. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I think in 2014 it was. So Colbert was satirizing basically Dan Snyder, who's the owner of the Washington football team, whose nickname is a slur. And so they did this bit where I think at the time Dan Snyder tried to deflect negative attention, right, by contributing to a charity or a fund for Native Americans, but still sort of, you know, ironically keeping the slur for the Native Americans as the official name. And so Colbert satirized that by, you know, making use of a character of his own. I think Ching Chong Ding Dong is the name of the character, in which he makes a contribution to an Asian charity in the name of Ching Chong Ding Dong.
Right. And this thing, it's a tweet. It goes out under Colbert's name, some controversial. We'll actually talk about his response to it, because he said, well, I don't do my own tweeting. But in any case, it raised a lot of eyebrows. Here's a guy who, you know, comes off as a progressive satirist, satirizing right-wing kind of talk. He does this thing perfectly in character and really gets slammed for it.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about the reaction and his response to that.
Yeah, so at the time, a person named Sui Park, who was called herself a hashtag activist, created a hashtag, I think it was called Cancel Colbert, hashtag Cancel Colbert. And in response to that tweet that was sent out, turns out on behalf of the show, not by Colbert himself. And the response was meant to show that even when you're trying to satirize racism, it matters for how you do so. And Park was basically responding to what she took to be sort of a long-standing tradition of using stereotypes about Asian people as a means of, making a joke or trying to perform a satirical performance. And there was something inappropriate about the use, the means to try to, satirize something they might consider racism as well. So it's like a use of racism to satirize racism, which is problematic, or at least part of the problem.
And so how did you feel about that?
So I sympathize with the considerations of how you get to the point.
Right.
So I do think we have to take care in, the ways in which the means that we use communicates a larger message. And it just so happens that this long-standing tradition of using, in this particular case, Asian stereotypes,
right,
is a sort of long-standing tradition that has implications for how you might think we, as a society, view Asian people. Right. So it has some kinds of detrimental consequences that may be unintended in this particular case.
Well, Jeff, how does that differ from? I mean, that's his shtick, and he often takes the point of view of kind of right-wing polemics, which are often very offensive. They're derogatory. They create others and make things much worse. This is the kind of right-wing mantra. He embodies it mm-hmm. as part of the satire. Where's the line?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a really good question. And I think Lavelle pointed to one of the most important considerations, which is, are you perpetuating oppression of a particular community as a means towards drawing attention to a different issue? And then a further problem with the tweet was that it stripped away all of the context that mm-hmm. might make it easy for people to interpret the comedy in that way in the first place, right? So even if people are viewing the original clip in context, they might appreciate the satirical purpose, and then we can raise those questions about whether or not we can permissibly use one group as a means to helping another group. But in the case of the tweet, all people saw right. was this derogatory comment about Asian people, and that made it, I think, doubly problematic. And that was part of why Colbert himself was so frustrated with the Twitter account.
Well, and also, who laughs at what, and why are mm-hmm. they laughing? I mean, if you hate racism and realize that Dan Snyder's perpetuation of racism by keeping the name of that team as it was, then you think, yeah, this is him saying I'm giving to this Native American charity is as absurd as mm-hmm. that. So that's mm-hmm. that's your point of view, and that may be why you laughed.
Yeah.
If you take a racist point of view, then you're laughing at Ching Chong Ding Dong or whatever phrase you use. It goes back to All in the Family, right? There were people who loved that show because it was obviously satirizing this kind of bourgeois working class family, and other people who just totally identified with Archie Bunker and they loved the guy, right? So who knows why but that's accounts for the ratings. All right, so let's talk about limits again. I want to play a clip here from Chris Rock, and here's where he crosses all kinds of boundaries here. Race, gender, let's listen.
There's white women in this room right now don't even have scales in their house. They know they gaining weight when too many black guys start hitting on them. It's like, these black guys are all over me. I gotta work out. That's right. Black men love a big white woman. The black man will drop kick Keira Knightley to get to Rosie O'Donnell. That's right, man. That's right. And that's what makes black women so mad. Because they know Rosie O'Donnell could walk into any black club in Harlem tonight and get her a black man. She don't even like men. But she can get her a black man. And it don't work the other way around. There ain't a bunch of black women out there trying to George from Seinfeld. That's right. If you see a black woman with an overweight white man, that means her credit is up.
Chris Rock. Well, I'm laughing. I'm laughing. I'm sorry. I'm laughing. What about that? What should we say about that?
Yeah. Chris is interesting. So, I think it's true that he's picking up on something that I think is a fairly common trope. A fairly well-known trope.
Right.
And so he's playing with it in certain kinds of ways, right?
Let me ask it this way. Does he have the right to tell that in a way that, a white comedian, maybe not even a Louis C.K., would have the right to tell that, to do that bit? And if so, why?
Yeah, so I do think that the identity of the speaker does matter. It does influence the kinds of, which you might call speech acts, we can perform, right? And so there's something about his particular identity as a sort of black man. And it's an issue that's sort of related to blackness or black men, I guess, in general. And so it gives him a certain kind of license because it's born out of a certain kind of experience, perhaps. And maybe it's the experience itself that licenses him to make certain kinds of speech utterances, speech acts or whatever, mm-hmm. that someone who doesn't have that experience couldn't make.
Yeah, and that gets us back to context. There mm-hmm. is a context. I mean, we do know something about it, presumably not everybody, but presumably people who go to see Chris Rock know something about Chris Rock and have a sense of where he is on things. And his color, his race, is a part of that context. Mm-hmm. And so maybe that's what we're getting to here.
Yeah, I think that that is a really important part of the context, the identity of the speaker and a sort of shared understanding of what this speech act is about and what the intention is. I think the identity of the audience also is a really important part of the context. Who will be listening to this and in what way will they hear it? This goes back to what you were saying before. So, there are lots of cases, especially for people who are famous enough. We were talking a little bit earlier about this perhaps being one of the reasons why Dave Chappelle walked away from his show back when it was massively successful on Comedy Central, was a recognition that even if his aim was to critique racism, there was a certain white proportion of his audience who were laughing at the jokes in the wrong way. They were hearing the wrong thing, and they were laughing straight up at the racist stereotypes rather than at the racism that those stereotypes were meant to be critiquing. And that made, I think, Dave Chappelle reasonably worry that his humor might be morally problematic, not because of its aim or impact on certain audiences, but because of its unintended impact on certain other audiences.
Well, and we noticed this back in the sort of the revival of minstrelsy when people began to, in African-American communities, take back some of their what had been appropriated and then began to notice that, yeah, maybe everybody's laughing in this audience, but not everybody's laughing for the same reason, right? And that becomes part of that takes us to the nature of art itself and where we should and whether we should create boundaries.
Yeah. And I think
because of our concern about how the audience is going to take it. I mean, let's move it over to Robert Mapplethorpe. I mean, if how you see that art, it's not Robert Mapplethorpe's business, to some extent. And so if you're amused by it, if you're entertained by it, then I can't help that to some extent.
Yeah, I mean, I think it speaks to the presumed responsibilities of both the creator, the artist, as well as the audience, right? So, Mapplethorpe, interesting figure, might have one certain kind of intention for the kinds of works that he created. But once you put it in public space, then you kind of lose control of that, right? So it's almost a free-for-all, a free grab.
And I think that makes it really difficult actually to know what to do, especially for people who do reach a wide audience. Because if you have a wide audience, if your work reaches millions or tens of millions of people, then I think you can trust that some people are going to take it in the right way and other people are going to take it in the wrong way. And if you do anything interesting enough to actually be provocative, to provoke important or uncomfortable conversation, probably some proportion of your audience will hear it the wrong way, and it might unintentionally perpetuate certain stereotypes, for example. And so I'm not even sure that that expected outcome is enough to make it the case that you should not do it. But I do think you need to think about the relative impacts and how much good you might be doing relative to how much harm you might be doing.
Well, and then the unintended consequences. If you are tweeting out, as Colbert, the Colbert Show did, this thing that many people took offense to, it goes out out of context and then gets put into context by the protest and becomes a public conversation, even for those who didn't see the tweet. So suddenly we're talking about things that had not been on our mind and we're made aware of a kind of sensitivity that otherwise would have passed our notice.
Yeah, that was something that South Park specialized in for years and years and still does every now and then. They say something provocative, something that probably goes a little bit too far, and then it sparks a public protest where people push back against them and we all learn something.
And then there are guys like Louis C.K., who seems to cross boundaries all the time, but he's got a famous bit about sort of how great it is to be white. Let's hear a little bit of Louis C.K. and how wonderful it is to be a white man.
Here's how great it is to be white. I could get in a time machine and go to any time, and it would be fucking awesome when I get there. That is exclusively a white privilege. Black people can't fuck with time machines. A black guy in a time machine is like, hey, I think before 1980, no thank you, I don't want to go. But I can go to any time. The year 2? I don't even know what was happening then. But I know when I get there, welcome, we have a table right here for you, sir. Oh, thank you. Oh, it's lovely here in the year 2. I can go to any time. In the past, I don't want to go to the future and find out what happens to white people, because we're going to pay hard for this shit. You got to know that. We're not going to just fall from number 1 to 2. And we totally deserve it. But for now, whee! Now, if you're white and you don't admit that it's great, you're an a-hole. It is great, and I'm a man. How many advantages could one person have? I'm a white man. You can't even hurt my feelings. What can you really call a white man that really digs deep? Hey, cracker.
Ugh, ruined my day. Boy, shouldn't have called me a cracker. You're bringing me back to owning land and people. What a drag.
Louis C.K. on The Advantages of Being White. It strikes me, I want to hear your take on this, but obviously he's very clearly satirizing white privilege. I mean, that's, and he's taking it on himself, and he's the white guy. So you feel like, well, he's got permission. What makes me a little uncomfortable with that piece is his assumption about what it is to be on the other side of that. I mean, he keeps talking about, you know, what it means. You get the sense that he's appropriating the what's harmful to about this, and that sometimes feels a little uncomfortable. But is there something fundamentally different in that kind of this kind of a take on racism?
Yeah, I mean, so I think, yeah, for one, you're right, that's pretty, the target is very unambiguous, right? So it's unambiguously targeting white privilege, and he's doing so in a way that isn't just sort of banal, right? So he's doing it in a way that does sort of provoke us in a way, kind of puts us into an uncomfortable space, which you might think effective satire, effective comedy that aims at sort of jostling our fragile views of the world shouldn't do. And so because of that, there's always going to be a danger of, you know, putting things in a certain kind of light that makes us uncomfortable in ways that may or may not be problematic. Mm-hmm. But so if you look at the overall, right, then you sort of look at the good that comes from, you know, putting these kinds of issues into public light and forcing us to think about them. Right. Mm-hmm.
And you said, Jeff, that when you were doing comedy, that you were doing improv, and that's when you started to feel uncomfortable at some of the things that would come up on the stage.
Yeah, I did. So I studied improv and performed improv for a few years in New York City. And that was a culture where a lot of people were doing a lot of really interesting work. And there was also a pretty big segment of that community where people would often go for shock value jokes. They would very quickly ramp up to a Holocaust joke or a 9/11 joke or a slavery joke to try to get a rise out of people. And I think for a long time, I loved that. I think a lot of people love it. You have this view, which is kind of true in some respects, that comedy needs to be this sort of sacred, protected area of discourse where we should feel free to say shocking and uncomfortable things, because part of the social value of comedy is to say shocking and uncomfortable things and make people sit with that discomfort. But I think a lot of people can sometimes use that as a license to be needlessly offensive to get a rise out of people. And it was sort of humbling when I started to realize that I might be guilty of that, and to try to figure out how you could be, for example, in an improvisational performance where you have to enthusiastically say yes and to your scene partner's initiations, while at the same time trying to respect certain boundaries and engage in shock value humor for good purposes and not bad purposes.
So you did that. You made a conscientious decision. Other comedians will not make that decision. In fact, they'll just go for the joke and for whatever reason, and audiences will make their judgments about who to go see and who not. Should we leave it to the performers and to the audiences to judge? How do you feel about that? Or is there some other court where this can be adjudicated?
Yeah, I do think ultimately it is something that audiences and we as sort of citizens have to adjudicate amongst ourselves. I don't think it's something that we could sort of call on the state to adjudicate. At least not in the U.S. It seems like an improbable thing.
Nor should we. I think one of the very standard things that people say about sort of politically correct speech police is that we are trying to regulate discourse, when in fact what we are trying to do is hold people accountable for the harms that they can cause while maintaining the view that free speech is incredibly valuable.
That's why talking about it is so important, and I'm glad you're having this conversation. Thank you both for being on the program today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lavelle Anderson is a philosophy professor at the University of Memphis. Jeff Sebo is a philosophy professor and associate director of UNC's Parr Center for Ethics. They're going to speak on the ethics of humor, navigating racial satire on Saturday, 2:15, part of a conference, Interdisciplinary Approaches to Humor. And there's nothing less funny than that, by the way. Can I say that the title, that's not funny?
No, the title is not funny.
Okay, okay. But anyway, it's an important conversation, and I'm glad you're here. Saturday, 2:15, we have all the details at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, two trains running, a film that looks at civil rights and the blues in the Deep South in the 60s. Stay tuned.